Good morning. We got some waves, some online waves. They're less formal online, in case you haven't noticed. At any time, they may go into the other room and get a snack. So this morning, I'm going to talk about RAIN, R-A-I-N, but I'm going to contextualize it for 10 minutes first. But it's in your program, so when I get to it, and it's also in the chat room, you might want to follow along. And if you don't have programs, maybe you can look off somewhere else's, or you can just listen. So practice period is drawing to a close, and I have not been part of it this year, but the focus has been on Shikan Taza, which means technique with sitting, just to sit. My first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, and my second teacher, Katagiri Roshi, that was what they had been trained in Japan. Shikan Taza, technique-less sitting, although with a straight posture. So the technique, I guess you could say, was having a straight posture, keeping the cosmic mudra, but generally referred to as technique-less sitting in the wider Buddhist community. So many of you have heard the story about me, my first teacher wanting me to start a little group. I think I just told it to Jerry yesterday in Palo Alto, my hometown, and once a week. And he would come down from San Francisco where he had the Zen Center. We did this maybe six or eight times, and we had three or four people there. He was an unknown then. There was the Suzuki method of music, but nobody had heard of this guy. And they heard of D.T. Suzuki was on the East Coast, not this guy. So nobody showed up. Then I put a little announcement in my hometown newspaper, and we had like 12 people show up. 12 people. And so he thought better. It was a meditation and a talk. So he gave them Shikan Taza instructions, which basically are straight spine, eyes half closed, cosmic mudra, tongue on the roof of your mouth. That was it. And even then I was a little audacious. Well, I guess I was a little audacious. I don't know. But I had to assemble the group. So I said, can you tell them something about technique? And he said, I already did. And I thought to myself, they won't come back. And many of them didn't come back. And my teacher, my first teacher, learned from that sometimes he needed to draw on the wider repertoire of tools in the Buddhist meditative tradition. So he began teaching watching your breath. Then after a while, he began teaching your breath. Then a while after that, he even gave me a mantra. So he was drawing on this wide, deep tradition. So why are techniques discarded? What's the deal about techniques? Well, Suzuki, my teacher again, my first teacher, talked about the dangers of stepladder Zen. Stepladder Zen, you're trying to get something, you're trying to get somewhere, you're not okay as you are. So you calm your mind a little bit and use this mantra or this breathing exercise, you'll get somewhere. Let's go. Reality's here. Reality's what we are, passing through us, and we're passing through it. Where do you want to go? That's the message that comes from this Buddhism that develops, starting with the Prajnaparamita Sutra, the Heart Sutra, which we chant every day here, the Heart Sutra. No stepladder Zen. Here's what the Heart Sutra says. And the Heart Sutra is, first of all, it says, there is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance. Well, the whole path is about starting with ignorance and moving toward clarity, moving toward stillness. But no, our sutra says there is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance. And then what about the Four Noble Truths? No cause of suffering, no cessation of suffering, no path to end suffering. So negated, all negated. No knowledge and no attainment. And with all this wiped out, then we can just really enjoy our lives and we're not caught by trying to get some. And then this theme which develops with the Heart Sutra, the Prajnaparamita Sutra, which it's the most concise example, is echoed by the sixth patriarch, Huineng, in the Platform Sutra, where the Eno, the guy who's in of the meditation hall, wants to be the successor of the teacher, and he writes a poem. This is the custom then, to show his deep awareness. And he says, the body is the tree, Bodhi tree, the tree of wisdom. The mind, the mirror of bright. Careful to wipe it clean, let no dust. You're wiping it clean. Multiple techniques to help you wipe it clean, because you know you get caught by all of your worries and fears. But the winning poem, and of course I'm being a little facetious here, but at the time it was the winning poem, was Huineng, the sixth ancestor in our lineage. The body is not the Bodhi tree. The mind is not the mirror of right, since the first, no thing exists, because everything's interdependent. Where can dust alight? And so that then maintains the technique-less meditation tradition. Now, in the whole Platform Sutra, he talks probably about five times about meditation, and he just assumes we're doing it, but he continues to give us no stepladder at all. And then we come to Dogen, the main man in our Japanese Soto Zen lineage, who acknowledges this importance of techniquelessness, but also says it's very important to sit still every day. So that's called Shikan Taza, just to sit. I'm trying to wipe the dust off the mirror, because the dust is the mirror. The dust and the mirror are interweaving. Everything is interweaving continually. And yet we get caught on something, right? Some idea. So we can think then about three movements. Two movements that lead up to Shikan Taza, just to sit. The first is from the Pali Canon, and that's based on dualism. Here's me, and there's Kato, and there's Ruzan. And we're separate. And we all need our own way of calming down so that we can open up to a non-separateness. But we are separate. And it's undeniable that we're separate. It's a dualist. The Pali canons are dualistic. It's not a negative word. They affirm the dualism of everything, the separation of everything. This table is not Tim. It's just not Tim. This is dualism. And Mahayana Buddhists and Zen Buddhists like to put it down, but this sure ain't Tim. This is a table. So... that's the Pali Canon. Then the Heart Sutra and Mahayana, non-duals. Everything is interconnected. The table is Tim, in fact, because without the table's very existence means that Tim feels connected to it by putting his hands on it. And when he puts his hands on her, he's in motion and it's in motion, because even the table is changing. If Tim keeps putting his cup on it, it's going to get some stains on it, and it won't be the table that it was before. So we have the movement of dualism, where we do lots of practices to try to open up to interdependence, a sense of connectedness and joy, love. And then we have non-dualism. We're already there. Let's just sit and appreciate it, not try to go anywhere. And then we have Dogen's non-dualism. Well, you should, to do that, you need to do Zazen. Without Zazen, you're never going to get it. Zazen, Zazen, Zazen for Dogen. Zazen. And so Dogen says in Fukan Zazengi, which is the first thing he wrote when he came back from China, and then he revised it when he was much older, it's Fukan Zazenji. Those were instructions for Zazen, Fukan Zazenji. Instructions for sitting, meditation. So we used to recite it during retreats at the end of the day. Then we switched to the Pali vows. I don't know why we did that, but it was fine. They're both cool. Pali is a little more beautiful, I think. I better not say that. Fukan's the same. But everything is different. But the Pali, they have much more tune. They use tune. We don't use tune. We're just one tone. So that's all I meant. Anyway, what was I saying? Oh, I'm talking about Fukan Zazenji. So, and it's one of his shortest treatise, Dogen's shortest treatise, and he spends like 3/4 of a page talking about posture, eyes, tongue on roof of mouth, cosmic mudra, and then you keep waiting. And this is what my students said. They keep waiting for, when's he going to talk about how I should do this, what I should do with my mind? And of course, he doesn't. Instead, he asks the question, what do you do with your mind? And then he answers, how does he answer? Think non-thinking. Whoa. Great. Think non-thinking. Great. Isn't that helpful? But he's saying, just come back to being and don't get caught on your thinking. And then he says, how do you do that? No, finally, how do we do that? Non-thinking. And then he ends. But he ends by saying, the Zazen I teach is not meditation. Aha! Meditation we're trying to get somewhere with the Zazen he teaches is not meditation. Interesting, isn't it? So, following in my two teachers' footsteps, 15 years ago, or 20 years ago, or maybe, I don't know, 25 years ago, I don't know, 30 years ago, I began teaching stuff like watching breathing, which they had already done, but also I began teaching mantras, and I began teaching using the Tetralama, which I don't have time to talk about today. And in workshops and retreats, we did those. Those are the more technique or oriented ways of practicing, because often we just get so lost in our Shikan Taza that we need something to bring us back, something. About 20 years ago, a woman named McDonald, maybe Karen McDonald, I'm not sure, came up with this RAIN, R-A-I-N, which I'm going to spend the rest of my time talking about. She was an Insight Meditation Society teacher. And then Jack Kornfield wrote about it 11, 12 years ago. And I started teaching it in one-to-one to people when they needed it, helping them with it. But I've never really given a Dharma talk on it before. I don't know why, but I haven't. And that's what I'm going to spend the next 10 or 15 minutes doing. Uh, One of the reasons I decided to do this was that my daughter, who's not a Buddhist, although she's sympathetic to what her dad's up to, she's that kind of daughter. I'm lucky to have that kind of daughter. And when she was a kid, she came here, actually. She came to the children's program we had here. Let's see, my daughter's 54, she's 53, a while ago. My daughter said, I was listening to NPR the other day, Dad, and there was this woman on the radio talking about meditation. I said, really? She said, yes, her name was Tara Brach, and she was talking about rain. And she said, Dad, you never told me about that. What's rain? And I said, well, Aaron, I think I'm going to give a talk on it, so you can listen to the talk, which you won't do. That's okay. So I thought, well, Jesus, Tara Brach has even been talking on the radio about it, and I've been teaching it one-to-one to people for 10, 12 years. I should talk about this. So here you go, the next 10 minutes or so. So one of the first times I used it was one-to-one was with a guy who had who was an alcoholic and had been sober for 5 years. And at some point, he came into my office and he said, God, he was just having this great urge to drink and he didn't know what to do. And so I started doing the rain thing with him. I said, oh, you have an urge to drink? Well, you recognize that. Good. You didn't just go out and guzzle. You recognize it. Because you can't do anything if you don't recognize. Now, when I teach RAIN, I teach RIANRAINRNAI, but I always have to start with recognition. If we don't recognize what's happening in our psyche, we can't open up. We can't. So then we talked about how he could accept it, but he did accept that he had this urge, just be with it or breathe through it, but it didn't go away. So then I said, well, can you inquire what do you think the trigger might have been? How did this happen? What goes through your mind? He said, My parakeet died. Oh. His parakeet died. No, let's not make fun of him. His parakeet died. He was living by himself. His parakeet was his best friend. And his parakeet died. So through the recognition, the superficial acceptance, the inquiry, the really looking into it, the investigating, he saw, oh, it's about the parakeet. He needed to grieve. He needed to be sad. He missed his parakeet. So the last one is nurture. RAIN, nurture. And he nurtured that, and he didn't drink. So now I'm going to go through RAIN with some specificity. R is the first noble truth of Buddhism. R is the entire world is burning. Burning with what? Burning with the fire of greed, hatred, and delusion, says Buddha from the Pali Canon. So we all are suffering because we're trying to pull into us those experiences that make us feel good, and that's the greed for those, and push away those that we hate, and then ignore everything else, greed, hatred, and delusion. So that's the first noble truth, but we need to recognize it. If we don't recognize when we're just grasping, when we're just pushing, how is it possible to move beyond it? That's the R in RAIN. That's the R in RAIN. Again, the entire world is burning. The entire world is in flames. He says this over and over again in the podcast. It's like we've forgotten, huh? The entire world is in flames. The entire world is going up in smoke. So we have a chance to recognize the flavor of our suffering. We have a chance to recognize the feeling of the bite and the memory of our suffering. Psychological, physical, emotional. And then we have the chance to accept it, to just embrace what is. Doesn't imply passive resignation, but a balanced mental state that observes equanimously In Pali, it's upeka, equanimity. And here's what he says. As a lake reflects whatever falls upon its surface, the mind with equanimity observes the experience without being disturbed. Accepting the full spectrum of emotion, just letting it, there it is, without getting swept away and without shoulda, coulda, woulda. It's not, shoulda, coulda, woulda is not acceptance. You need to do more inquiry if you're saying, I shouldn't be like this. What's going on? So you can have real acceptance. As long as you say, I shouldn't be feeling this, you're not really accepting. That's why inquiry is so important. Investigating. This is the translation of it, vipassana. Pasana to see, v into, vipassana, investigating, seeing into. Here's what Buddha says. A disciple, when touched by feeling, investigates its nature. When touched by perception, investigates its nature. When touched by thought, investigates its nature, and so on for all mental phenomena. And his teaching really centers on that. Of course, he went through those 6 years when he just questioned. He didn't take anything on faith. He questioned everything. And finally, nurture. Now, when I first learned it, it was R-A-I-N, non-attached instead of nurture. But I didn't like that. I didn't want to use that, and I didn't use it. And then soon they switched to and started using nurture. They, meaning the Jack Kornfields and Insight Meditation Society. Why? Because as recognize, accept, inquire, really we have to nurture that. And if we leap toward non-attachment, it's just in our head. We just want to be good boys and girls. Real non-attachment comes from nurturance, comes from opening up to what is and not kicking any part of yourself out. As long as you're kicking part of yourself out, your non-attachment's kind of fake. A lot of religious people have a lot of fake non-attachment. I don't want to just say religious, maybe irreligious people too. Yeah, irreligious people too. Yeah. My dad was an atheist. So that's metta. And then in the Pali Canon's metta, loving kindness. And we, last yesterday on Saturday mornings, we recite the Metta Sutta, which is the Pali Canon, comes right from Pali Canon. Here's Buddha. Just as a mother would protect her only child with her own life, let him, sorry for the pronoun, I'm just doing it the way that, let them cultivate boundless thoughts of loving kindness toward all beings. Treat ourselves with the same kindness and understanding we want to treat others. All of my students for the last 25 or 30 years, not all of them, half of my students for the last 25 or 30 years have had the hardest time being kind to themselves. They can be kind to their dog, they can be kind to their spouse, they can be kind to the neighbor, but not themselves. At least half of my students really struggle. So nurture. So now I want to finish. Let's see, I wonder what time it is. Oh, 10:26, so I went through this kind of quickly. In the conventional sense of time, that is. Now I want to talk about five types of suffering that are likely to come up in meditation that we can practice with, rain with, or rena with, or rion with. You have to have the heart. The first is restlessness. The second is boredom. The third is pain. The fourth is repetitive thinking. And the fifth is strong emotion. And if you sat for long periods of time, you have experienced all of these. And maybe you're so non-attached, you haven't. But I still do after 94 years of sitting myself. So I'm going to talk about each of them a little bit. Restlessness. Restlessness. Mind is constantly jumping from thought to thought. You notice it more in your meditation, especially in retreat. Some people go crazy almost. They say I'm going crazy, but I say, you're not going crazy. You're just, your mind is just tripping out. You know? Oh, no. Go walk on the porch. I say, don't sit in the zendo. Go walk on the porch. And they say, well, maybe that'll help a little bit. That helps a little bit. The mind is constantly jumping from thought to thought. So we can't do shikantaza. We can't do technique-less sitting. We can't stay on our breath. We get frustrated. But we can allow, we can accept. Instead of trying to force stillness, we can, oh, this is what's going on. It's a natural phenomenon that happens to human beings. And investigate it. Is there an underlying physical discomfort? Well, usually in a retreat, there is. Are you worried about something? Well, so much of our lives, we are worried about something. When we just sit facing a wall, that worry is going to magnify itself, even if we've got the best technique. Understanding the source, nurturing it, offering yourself kindness, remembering the nature of the mind is to wander. Human mind, we don't have the instincts that most other animals have to protect us from harm. So our mind is cruising around all the time, looking for potential danger. It's cruising around looking for potential danger. And we can all learn to watch the movie. Just watch the movie, as Suzuki would say. Just watch it. After we've done rain, come back gently to our breath or our technique with sitting, and we can transform restlessness into an opportunity. Practice acceptance. Whatever kind of movie it is, it's just okay. It's just okay. Just perfectly fine. Perfectly fine. Just a move. Next one, boredom. If any of you claim you're never bored in meditation, I don't believe you either. I just don't believe you. I've been around, you know. I've had these experiences myself. Boredom. First, we have to recognize it. Oh, my meditation is becoming monotonous. I mean, noticing how boring it feels just to sit facing this stupid wall. And then I begin to get discouraged. I've been sitting for 83 months or 83 days or 83 years and still get bored. Oh, I should take up something else instead of this sitting. Right? It hasn't improved in 83 years. I'm pretty stupid. I should take up something else, don't you think? That's what the mind says. The mind that's always feels insecure and pulls things to it, pushes things away to try to find an equanimity. But the real equanimity comes from just being and doing these practices to help us just learn to be. Be. So allow, instead of judging yourself or feeling bored, just acknowledge it. It happens to everyone. And then investigate. Am I resisting the stillness itself? Am I resisting a desire for something more stimulating? Gentle curiosity. Loving curiosity. Understanding this and helps us be patient. Be patient. Nurture. Compassion. Compassion. Remind yourself, boredom's natural. You can learn to be present with whatever in uninteresting experiences. And become more grounded. Third, pain. Well, if you're a Zen meditator, you experience pain. A lot of other meditators get to wiggle around and move and wiggle. Go do something else. Zen meditator. Oh, pain. Again, this is the model of meditation that Suzuki and Katagiri brought to this country that I was trained in, fortunately or unfortunately. I think it's fortunate. I think it's fortunate. There's good fortune all around, even in bad fortune. There's good fortune. It's here. It's here, supporting us. Pain. Back pain during meditation, tight muscles during meditation. Neck pain during meditation, even this morning, pulling my neck in. And if you don't know what I mean, you're not really doing Zen meditation. Zen meditation. So recognize the desire to move and escape the discomfort. And you know, I have given talks at Common Ground. I gave talks at two Vipassana centers in California. And they get to move when they're in pain. They get to move. It's a different tradition. Didn't pass through Japan and China and Japan. Different tradition. So acknowledge the pain without judging, accepting that some discomfort is natural during prolonged sitting and actually during life, which you get to be my age if you don't know about that. Living. Observe it with curiosity. Where is it? Is it constant or changing? Understanding its nature can help you detach from negativity about it. Just let it be, let it come, let it go. It comes in waves, it goes in waves. And of course, you don't want to overdo it. I mean, we followed Suzuki's instructions too much to the T, and one of my friends blew out their knees. So don't do that. We're Americans. We did not grow up sitting on the ground. So don't do that. But find your middle way. Find your middle way. Nurture self-compassion. You can maintain a gentle focus on your breath even with pain. You can. You can adjust your posture a little bit without disturbing your neighbor. You can do that. And get some relief. So using rain with pain can help you feel some calmness. Observe pain so that when you're older and you have real pain, it's just pain. Just pain. I don't promise you will have more pain when you get older, but that's another story. It's quite likely. I guess I will say something about that here. I didn't want to veer away because I wanted to get through this, but it's only 10:36. So I have an old Zen men's group that meets once a month, and it's been meeting for 50 years. That makes me really old. 50 years we've been meeting once a month. And as we meet decade after decade, what becomes more thematic in our lunches? What do you think might become more thematic in our lunches? Anybody have any idea? Finally, I think I said, come on, you guys, time out. Let's visit together and not just do pain for the whole lunch. So now they're not doing it anymore. But we're feeling it anyway. So The last two, repetitive thoughts and strong emotion. Repetitive thoughts, strong emotion. Applying rein to those, you can develop a more mindful and compassionate way just to be, to navigate your internal being. Be with your internal being. So, repetitive thoughts which come up in meditation. And if you say repetitive thoughts don't come up, I don't believe you. If you say, I know how to be in deep samadhi, so repetitive thoughts don't come up, I completely don't believe you. Not only are they repetitive, they're redundant, they cycle, they won't get recycled, they just seem to keep cycling. You want to recycle, compost them, but they keep coming back. So a thought about an upcoming deadline at work keeps popping into your head. Becomes a loop, pulling you away from your breath or shikantaza, just sitting. You recognize, you notice it. You simply observe it as a mental event. You allow it. Instead of pushing the thought away, you acknowledge its presence. There it is. Well, it exists without getting caught in its content. You investigate it. What's this thought all about? Is it the deadline itself that's causing this anxiety? Or is it the fear of not being prepared? Understanding the root is important. And then we nurture. We offer ourselves kindness. We recognize that obtrusive thoughts are a normal part of meditation. We remind ourselves that we can gently guide our attention back to our breath or our posture. Here's how this plays out. You acknowledge the thought about the deadline. There's that thought about the deadline. You allow it to be present without judging it. That's okay. Thoughts come and go. You investigate it. Is it the deadline itself or am I worried? You nurture. It's natural to have these. Just bring my mind back. Finally, emotion. Now, some people tell me that emotion never comes up in your sitting. I actually don't believe that either. Mostly it's men who tell me. Do men have less emotion than women? I don't think so. I think men are more repressed about emotion than women. That's what I think. Emotion. Unexpected, just you're calm, you're sitting, you've been sitting this morning, you've been to 20 minutes of the sitting, and it's good. And then some sadness wells up, some anger wells. What's that all about? Can you just be with that? Can you just be with that? Let's say you're meditating peacefully, focusing on your breath, when a wave of sadness rushes over you. It's possible. Quite possible, maybe tears well up in your eyes. Maybe you feel a heaviness in your chest. It's possible. Recognize it. Notice the sadness without judging it. Acknowledge its presence and the physical sensations associated with it. Investigate. Explore the sadness. Where this might be coming from. If it's not my parakeet, what is it? Is it a specific event? A general feeling of loneliness? Sitting facing a wall can be pretty lonely. Or something deeper. Understanding the source can provide insight and equanimity. And nurture. Offer yourself compassion. Remind yourself that sadness is natural. It's okay to feel sad during meditation. Perfectly okay. So you acknowledge the sadness. You say, oh, there's sadness. And you feel the tears. You allow it to be there. You may be a little embarrassed if you're sitting between two people. And then you just be with the embarrassment. You just be with the embarrassment. Fine. investigate it. What's it do to him? What's it do to him? Maybe so many different things. Anyway, I'm going to run out of time. You nurture. It's natural to feel all these emotions. If we're not going to feel these during meditation, when will we feel them? Well, come in. It's healthy. It's healthy. Dogen says, whole being Buddha nature. Don't kick out any emotions. Let them pass through. Let them pass through. Equanimously. And then when you're ready, return to your meditation. I mean, your life and your breathing or your Qigong Taizo or whatever you do. Emotions like sadness could be a gateway to discovering something deep, tapping into something deep, maybe even your own still nature. Maybe your own still nature, which is the nature of all life. Maybe that. Possible. It's possible. So usually I wake up in the morning, especially this time of year. It's wonderful to wake up. Green outside, the sun rising. Wow, spring, summer. We don't have much spring in Minnesota. Where I come from, we have a really big spring. But here, I'm going to say you guys, although I've been here for 50 years, I still think of it, you guys don't have spring. isn't that weird? I've been here for 50 years and I still say you guys. Talk about projection from the past, right? Anyway, I was talking about some experience I had Wednesday morning. So I usually wake up, I'm ready. And I feel just a love of being when I wake up. But Wednesday morning when I woke up, I felt confused. And so confusion is a form of suffering, right? I felt confused. And I recognize that I'm confused. I accepted it, but just superficially. And it was still hanging around. It wasn't really accepted. You know, we use this fake acceptance all the time, but it's not the real deal. Because we're trying to be accepted. But acceptance only comes through openness and kindness and love. That's the only way it comes. Anyway, then I... inquired. I was following rain. I just did this. Then I inquired. Actually, afterwards, I turned this into a rain deal, right? But these things did happen. I asked myself, what's going on? Oh, you're giving a talk this Sunday, and your two retreat talks are no good. I was going to give lead a retreat over the weekend, but it got canceled because they are quite elaborate, and you can't partition those. Oh, so that was it. I was confused about what I was going to say on Sunday. And so I nurtured that. I let go of all the shoulds. And then just decided I'd talk about rain. So there you go. There you go. So good practices, many good practices, many good techniques. I'm challenging my teachers, no stepladder Zen. I challenge them all the time, but you know, you can challenge someone you're in love with. It's okay. It's okay. What do you do? Qigong Taizo is good, but so is breathing, so is counting the breathing, so is mantras, so is rain, so is Tetra Lama. This is helping us open into helping dukkha, D-U-K-K-H-A, which means suffering, open into sukha, happiness, S-U-K-K-H-A. We have a natural, innate happiness because we feel connected to everyone below the level of our worries and concerns. And through these practices, these practices of no practice, no technique, and all these techniques, we settle it. Tufu calls this the cosmos awakening to itself. Each of us is the cosmos awakening to itself. We may not like this cosmos. This cosmos likes us. It likes us. Let's just awaken to it as it is. So that's what I want to say. And there's a little bit of time for questions or comments. Either people online or in the room. And there's someone behind. Yes.
Yes. The concept still with rain and energy.
Can you speak a little louder?
I sure can. With the concept of rain, could you give some guidance as to finding them a little path with particularly the inquiry, the I part of this, before it turns into chasing other rabbits down rabbit holes?
Can I give you an idea about when to use the inquiry or how to use the inquiry?
I'm open to all suggestions and guidance.
Pardon?
I am open to all suggestions and guidance.
Oh. Well, as soon as you recognize something that's clouding things, it's good to look into it. Not intellectually, but what's going on here? What's going on here? Because if you don't look into it and you just operate on faith, you won't really accept. So everything, and what's the how? The how is just asking, what's going on here, with curiosity. And of course, if after a while you may think, I can't figure it out. Well, that's okay. Then you just breathe and you come back to it later if it's still getting you. And you accept it. Sometimes the inquiry isn't going to lead any deeper. Then you just come back to it in acceptance, because sometimes it won't. But without inquiry, how can we open up to hoping Buddha nature, hoping no Buddha nature, the cosmos being aware of itself, just as little Tim, the cosmos being aware of itself, just as little Jim is the cosmos being aware of itself. So I don't think there's a how. There has to be an aspiration. Really, it's impossible to do this path without a pretty strong aspiration. But if you suffer enough and you don't intoxicate yourself with drugs or alcohol or sex or whatever, TV or iPhone, your aspiration can cause you to be curious, 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 but not all intellectually curious. You understand what I mean when I say not all intellectually curious?
You
keep asking. You keep it very simple, and you ask, and you ask. And if some kind of solution comes up, that's fine. But you come back to the simplicity of asking. Of asking. If there are more than three or four sentences, then you're getting all intellectually. Intellectually involved is fine, but it won't bring you this depth. Does that make sense?
Much more, yes.
Okay. Jerry.
I had pretty much the same question. Yeah, I think it's the most dangerous, if you will, because that leads you into a rabbit hole. I mean, you can say, if you start following it.
It is more dangerous. Pardon?
That coming. Not going too far with it, holding it.
Yes, not going too far with it, holding it. So the Zen teacher said in the Chan teaching, asking the question is enough. Students were all wanting an answer. He said, no, ask the question. This is Dogen's natural calm. We have natural calms and we want to figure them out in our head, but they're only going to get figured out by asking in more depth beyond our head. But it doesn't mean we kick our head.
So two
of you, let's see, Barbara and then Don.
So I use rain to get through a very difficult.
Can you speak loud?
I use rain to get through a very difficult time in my life.
Uh-huh.
And when you talk about inquiry, I think it's, for me, I didn't inquire with my head, I inquired with my heart. And then trusting. Trusting your deeper self to come up with the right information. And sometimes you have to wait a while for that. You just tell your deeper self, your heart will work on it. And sometimes you get a greater insight.
That's right. Thank you, Barbara. Thank you. And you know, we have this word in Sanskrit, citta, C-I-T-T-A, which means heart mind. Heart mind, right here, heart mind. I mean, it's not literally right here, but that's what we think of. And usually the mind is separate from the heart, because heart mind is where we ask, heart mind. No division between heart and mind. No division. And Dom.
Yeah, if I may provide or kind of like suggest another technique that they're thinking about that inquiry.
Sure.
You know, kind of if you could just and feel free to offer commentary. If you could distill that question or kind of what you're inquiring and almost use it as a mantra.
That's right.
And continue to repeat.
That's right. Very good.
And then even so, and as you kind of focus on that mantra, answers will arise, but then let them go.
Very good.
And return back to the mantra.
Very good. Yes.
And yes. With enough time, I think whenever I've done it in the past, sometimes it takes a couple seconds, but when you come to an answer that is true, it will kind of start to resonate within, you know, kind of like, you know, within your mind or body or whatever you want to call it. But the thing is, continuing focusing on that mantra, letting answers go until you come to a place where you feel comfortable that you are correct, that you're on the right
path. Thank you. Very good. Very good. Let's see. Well, I want to give, before Raymond, I want to give, see if anybody online wants to ask anything or say anything. Then anybody online want to ask anything or say anything?
I thought this talk was wonderfully helpful, Tim. Thanks very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Very welcome. I guess nobody, I guess Raymond, you're on.
I just wanted to share in manufacturing, lean manufacturing, which is there's a Japanese technique to try to get to the root cause.
Yes.
And it's called the five whys.
Yes.
And you ask the question why, and then to the answer you ask it why. And typically by the fifth time, you've reached.
Yes. Is that part of lean, what called lean? Lean, yes. Yes. Could you guys hear him? Okay. Well, there is time for one more if anybody has anything. Oh, yes.
What do you,
Kim?
What do you do, Tim, when things are, I don't even know how to phrase this question, when things are going well, when you're in some kind of nothing, whatever you want to call that, samadhi, whatever, and then it dissolves. Then we're back into what we're talking about now. And I don't know what my question is, but sometimes this comes as a gift, as a kind of gracious gift of nada. So what?
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. Well, is there anything more? Anyone need it? That's the cosmos being aware of itself through you. And awareness doesn't mean all la di da.
I want to keep it going. You can't make it happen.
No, you can't. You can't. No, no. Thank you. Well, let's close on that note.
Thank you.